Unlike the Hamas and the Hezbollah, which invested a large part of their resources in social activities, the Islamic Jihad had a sole purpose: terror. It was based on a very small and very compartmentalized number of cells, composed of Palestinians who had no other purpose but to fight Israel. Shakaki himself was considered by the Palestinian diaspora to be the ideological father of suicide terrorism. He was the first to find in Islam's holy teachings a legitimization for suicide bombings and killings. Shakaki's organization was responsible for a long list of bloody terrorist attacks. 16 dead in the attack on a 405 bus on the road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem on July 6, 1989. 9 dead in the attack on a bus of Israeli tourists close to Cairo on February 4, 1990. 8 dead in the bombing of a bus by Kfar Darom in southern Israel on November 20, 2000. 3 soldiers killed at the suicide attack on the Netzarim roadblock in the Gaza Strip on November 11, 1994, and the terrible bombing in Beit Lid, where 21 people died on January 22, 1995. He had rightfully earned the death sentence that the Mossad carried out in a Malta street. After Shakaki's death, the Islamic Jihad almost collapsed, and it took years for the organization to recover from the death of its leader. Israel never assumed responsibility for the assassination. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said, "I did not know about the assassination, but if it is true, I shall not be sorry." A short while afterward, Yitzhak Rabin himself was assassinated, not by a Palestinian terrorist, but by a Jewish fanatic. Chapter 17. Fiasco in Amman.
"Baba, Baba!"
"Father, Father!" the little girl cried, jumped out of the black jeep, and ran after her father into a tall office building in central Amman, Jordan.
"Baba!"
she called, and triggered one of the worst mishaps in the history of the Mossad. The operation had been masterly planned. Even though it seemed somewhat clumsy, it had every chance of success. Its goal was to kill Khalid Mesh'al, the newly appointed head of the Hamas Political Bureau. Mesh'al, a 41-year-old computer engineer, was a handsome man, sporting a well-groomed black beard. He was a rising leader of Hamas, which in the previous few years had become Israel's worst enemy. This terrorist organization, fueled by Islamic fanaticism, had replaced the PLO in the ruthless fight against Israel after Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin had made a move toward peace by signing the Oslo agreements together in September 1993. The senior officers of Mossad had proposed Mesh'al as a target for assassination after a deadly suicide bombing in Jerusalem on July 30, 1997. 2 terrorists blew themselves up in the crowded Mahane Yehuda market, killing 16 Israelis and wounding 169 others. Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu called an emergency meeting of the cabinet that decided to kill one of the Hamas leaders. The Ramsad, General Danny Yatom, who had been appointed to his post in 1996, was tasked by Netanyahu with designating which man should die. Yatom had a long military career behind him. A muscular, bald man with a ready smile, he had been a fighter and a deputy commander at Sayeret Matkal, then an armor corps officer, and the head of the Israeli Central Command with the rank of Major General. Devoted heart and soul to Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, he had been his military secretary. After Rabin's death, he was, to the surprise of many, appointed head of the Mossad. All those who knew him appreciated his efficiency and his military record, but he seemed to lack all of the qualities needed in a man at the helm of a secret organization. His appointment seemed to be more of a tribute to the dead Rabin than a choice of the best man for the job. After his meeting with Netanyahu in early August 1997, Yatom called an urgent meeting at Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv. The heads of the Mossad's major departments were summoned to the conference room. These were Eliza Magen, Yatom's deputy, B, the head of Caesarea, the Special Operations Department, Yitzhak Barzilai, the head of Tevel, department in charge of cooperation with foreign intelligence services, Ilan Mizrahi, head of Tzomet, the intelligence gathering department, D, head of Neviot, which specialized in penetrating enemy targets, and the heads of the research and terrorism departments. Persons designed by a letter instead of a name are still on active duty. At first, the discussion reached a dead end. The Mossad did not have a full list of the Hamas leaders. The most prominent Hamas chief was Musa Mohammed Abu Marzouk, but the man carried an American passport, and any attack on him could create complications with the United States. Khalid Mesh'al, on the other hand, was unanimously regarded as a suitable target, but his office was in Amman. After signing a peace agreement with Jordan in October 1994, Prime Minister Rabin had prohibited all Mossad operations in that country. As long as General Yatom was Rabin's military secretary, he followed Rabin's order to the letter. But after he was appointed Ramsad, Yatom decided to ignore the late Rabin's instructions and proposed Mesh'al's name to Prime Minister Netanyahu. His suggestion was backed by the head of Caesarea and his intelligence officer, Mishka Ben David. Netanyahu agreed, yet determined to avoid a crisis with Jordan, he ordered a quiet operation, not a showy hit. Yatom charged the Kidon group, the elite unit of Caesarea, with executing the operation. A doctor of biochemistry, employed at the Mossad Research Department, suggested using a lethal poison that had been developed in the Biology Institute in Nes Ziona. A few drops of this poison, sprinkled on a person's skin, would cause his death. This poison did not leave any traces and could not be detected even in an autopsy. A similar poison was used in the past, in the Godiva affair against Wadi Hadad, the head of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. See Chapter 16. "The poison thing didn't bother you?" Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman asked Mishka Ben David years later. "Such a disgusting way to die." "Tell me," Ben David answered. "A bullet in the head or a missile fired at the car is more humane than poison? It would have been better, of course, if there was no need to kill people, but in the war against terror, this is unavoidable. The Prime Minister's decision to carry out a quiet operation in order not to harm our relations with Jordan was a logical one." In the summer of 1997, some passers-by in a Tel Aviv street saw two young men shaking cans of Coca-Cola, then pulling their tabs and opening them. The bubbly drinks squirted out with a sizzling noise. For a moment, the people on the street cast annoyed looks at the two young men and then kept moving. They could not guess that the two were Mossad agents, rehearsing Mesh'al's killing. One of them would open a Coke can in his vicinity to divert his attention, while the other would squirt a few drops of poison at the back of his neck. 6 weeks before the operation, in August 1997, the first agents arrived in Jordan. They carried foreign passports and followed Mesh'al's daily routine. When does he leave his home? Who rides with him in his car in the morning? What is the route he takes and where does he go? How is the road traffic when he travels? They measured the time between his getting out of his car and entering this or that building, checked if he stopped on his way to talk with other people entering the same building, and collected any other bits of information that could influence the operational plans. The advance team's report to Kidon headquarters summed up the results of the preliminary mission. Every morning, Mesh'al came out of his house without bodyguards. He got into a black SUV driven by his assistant and headed for the Palestinian Relief Bureau at the Shamia Center building in Amman. After Mesh'al got out, the driver departed with the vehicle. Mesh'al walked the short distance to the building and entered. the Palestinian Relief Bureau was a cover name for the Hamas headquarters in the Jordanian capital. The surveillance report by the advance team also suggested the best way to hit Meshal. In the morning, on the sidewalk, after he got out of the SUV and walked to the office building. The preparations continued through the summer. Surveillance, dispatch of other auxiliary teams to Amman, renting safe houses and vehicles. Suddenly, on September 4th, another terrorist attack shook Jerusalem. Three Hamas members blew themselves up on Ben Yehuda Street, killing five Israelis, wounding 181. Israel could not wait any longer. It was time to act. September 24th, 1997, a day before the operation. A couple of tourists linger by the pool of a big Amman hotel. The man is wearing a white bathrobe. He tells the hotel employees that he is recovering from a heart attack. His slow, cautious walk proves that he still suffers from the side effects of his illness. The young woman with him is a doctor. Every once in a while, she checks his pulse and his blood pressure. Most of the time, they lie on the chaises by the pool. The heart patient is Mishka Ben David, in charge of the communication between the Mossad headquarters and the agents on the ground. The woman, a Mossad agent as well, is a real doctor who carries an injection of antidote to the poison destined to kill Meshal. The antidote is capable of neutralizing the effect of the poison. It would be used if one or more Kidon agents are accidentally exposed to some drops of the poison during the operation. An immediate shot of the antidote would be the only way to save them from certain death. While the phony patient and the doctor are waiting by the pool, the HIT team is making the last preparations. In the last few days, several agents have arrived to Amman. They will drive the escape vehicles and fill secondary roles. After them, the HIT team itself has arrived. Two Kidon agents, posing as Canadian tourists by the names of Sean Kendall and Barry Beads. The two of them have checked into the Intercontinental Hotel. In retrospect, disturbing questions arise concerning these two. Why were they chosen, even though they had never operated in an Arab country? And why did they get Canadian passports, when even the most superficial inspection would prove that they were not Canadians? Their English was stilted, their accent Israeli, and their cover certain to be pulverized by a serious investigation. But all this paled in comparison with the surveillance team's error, exposed only after the operation was launched. The hit was to take place at the entrance to the Shamia Center building, where Meshal's office was located. The encounter between the Kidon agents and Meshal was supposed to be quick and deadly. Sean and Barry had to approach Meshal, spray the liquid poison on the back of his neck, and escape aboard a vehicle that was waiting nearby. The two Canadians were well prepared after their training in the streets of Tel Aviv. Sean was to hold the Coke can. When facing Meshal, he had to pull the tab and accidentally spray the Coke in his direction. But the Coke, of course, was not the story. Barry, who held the small container of poison, was the main figure in the operation. In a matter of seconds, he had to spray the poison from his container toward Meshal. The Coke can was supposed to divert his attention from the poison spray. The liquid would spread on his skin and make him die of a heart attack. Two other tourists, a man and a woman, were to wait inside the building lobby in case the HIT team needed help. For instance, Meshal might walk too fast toward the building, and the two Canadians may not be able to get to him. In such case, the tourists were supposed to get out of the building and bump into Meshal, delaying him until the hit men reached him. That way, the Mossad planners believed, there would be no confrontation with the Jordanians. The key to success was the situation on the ground. Target area clean of bodyguards, family members, acquaintances, police officers, Hamas militants, and others who could thwart the hit. And indeed, the instructions to the eight agents sent to Jordan were clear. Carry out the operations only if all the above conditions are fulfilled. Danny Atom maintains that he had told the agents, "If the conditions differ from the original planning, we can always execute at a later date." As far as we know, that was what really happened. The agents came several times to the target area, but aborted the hit because of unexpected problems. The presence of Jordanian police officers in the area, bodyguards who escorted Mesh'al, or Mesh'al's last-minute decision not to go to the office that day. September 25, 1997, D-Day. The operation commander takes position across the street, in front of the office building. It has been decided not to use cell phones or electronic communication instruments in the target area, and the agents would communicate by manual and body signs. In case they needed to abort the operation, the commander would notify the two agents by removing his visor cap. Behind the building, the getaway car is waiting for the two hitmen. Sean and Barry are in place, and so is the couple in the lobby of the building. Everything is ready. In Mesh'al's home, it is almost a perfectly routine morning, but for a small last-minute change. Mesh'al's wife asks him to take the two children to school today. Usually she takes care of that. The children get in the SUV with their father, but the Mossad surveillance team does not notice them and reports to the Kidon people that Mesh'al is on his way, alone in the car with the driver. The agents fail to notice the two kids who are sitting in the back. The car windows are tinted, and the children cannot be seen from the outside. Mesh'al arrives to the Shamia Center, gets out of the car, crosses the sidewalk, and starts climbing the stairs leading to the building entrance. The two hitmen approach him. 10 meters. 5. 3. Suddenly, Mesh'al's little girl emerges from the SUV.
"Baba! Baba!"
she calls and starts running toward her father. The driver jumps out of the car and follows the child. The operation commander, who is positioned across the street, notices the child. He removes his hat and tries to signal to his men to abort. But in these critical seconds, the two agents are getting around one of the concrete pillars at the building entrance, and for a moment they lose contact with their commander. And even worse, they don't see the little girl and the driver who runs after her. The hitmen proceed with their mission. They reach Mesh'al, and Sean shakes the Coke can and pulls the tab. But today, for the first time, the tab tears, but the can does not open. The diversion fails. Barry, nonetheless, raises his hand to spray the poison on Mesh'al's neck. But Mesh'al's driver, who runs after the child, sees the stranger's raised hand and thinks he is trying to stab his boss. He starts to shout, darts toward Barry, and tries to strike him with a folded newspaper. Mesh'al hears his driver's shouts and turns back. At this moment, Barry sprays the poison and a few drops fall on Mesh'al's ear. He feels only a light prick, but realizes that something is wrong and runs away as fast as he can. Sean and Barry rush toward the getaway car. At this point, another character enters the scene, Mohammed Abu Saif, a Hamas militant who is on his way to deliver some documents to Mesh'al. He hears the shouts and sees the confrontation between his leader and the two agents. While Mesh'al is running for his life, Abu Saif tries to stop Sean and Barry, who are about to get into the getaway car, a third snag in the ill-fated mission. He struggles with Sean, who hits him with the unopened Coke can. Sean and Barry manage to jump into the car. It darts off. But then, they make the most critical mistake in the operation. The driver tells Sean and Barry that he has seen Abu Saif writing down the car's license plate number. The two hitmen decide on the spot to abandon the car. They fear that Abu Saif would alert the police, and if they get to the hotel with that car, as planned, they will be arrested there. They have no address of a safe house, no other escape route. Barry and Sean get out of the car after a few blocks, and the driver speeds away to get rid of the car. But it turns out that Abu Saif, a veteran of the Mujahideen who had fought in Afghanistan against the Russians, has not given up. The stubborn and agile man has been running after the Israeli's car. Sean and Barry, who have left the car and are now walking on both sides of the street, have not noticed him till he jumps Barry, grabs his shirt, and starts yelling that this man has tried to hurt Meshal. Sean, who is on the other sidewalk across the street, rushes to his partner's aid. He slams into Abu Saif, wounding him slightly in the head, and throws him into a roadside ditch. The struggle continues. A crowd quickly assembles around them and converges on the two foreigners who seem to be beating a fellow Arab. A police officer appears on the scene, disperses the crowd, stops a taxi, and makes the two strangers and the badly beaten Abu Saif get in. The taxi heads for the police station. At the police station, the officers at first thought that Abu Saif had attacked the two foreigners, but after he recovered from the beating, he accused them of assaulting Meshal. The Jordanian investigators checked the passports of the two men, and when they realized they were Canadians, they alerted the Canadian consul. The diplomat spoke for a short while with Sean and Barry and told the Jordanians, "I don't know who these guys are, but of one thing I am sure, Canadians they're not." The Jordanians, still unaware of the treasure that had fallen into their hands, decided to keep the two foreigners in custody and allowed them to make one phone call. The agents reached Mossad operational headquarters in Europe and reported their arrest. Simultaneously, a female agent, who had taken part in the operation and watched the scene in front of Shamia Center, understood that a serious failure had occurred and decided to alert the heart patient, Mishka Ben David, the senior Mossad officer in the Jordanian capital. She rushed to his hotel. Seeing her, he immediately understood that the worst had happened. The standing orders for the operation were that no one was to come near him, with one exception. If the operation had misfired and all agents had to be pulled out of the country at once. Ben David discarded his robe, dressed quickly, and hurried to the secret meeting place that had been prepared beforehand. Soon after, the operation commander arrived as well. He, too, was aware of the failure. Yet none of them could imagine the chaos that was about to unfold. Mishka sent an immediate report to Mossad headquarters. Ramsad Dani Yatom discussed the situation with the department heads and decided to order the agents to seek refuge at the Israeli embassy in Amman and not use the escape route they had rehearsed beforehand. Back in Jordan, everyone left the meeting place and headed for the embassy. Only the doctor remained in the hotel. In the meantime, in a different Amman neighborhood, the poison had begun its deadly work on Meshal. He collapsed and was taken to a hospital. The Israelis realized that if he did not get the antidote, he was going to die in a few hours. Netanyahu received the bad news in his car while on his way to a Jewish New Year's party at Mossad headquarters. An amazing coincidence. Yatom briefed the prime minister. Netanyahu was appalled. He decided that the Ramsad should fly to Amman immediately, meet with King Hussein, and tell him everything, without any diversion or lies. From Mossad headquarters, the prime minister called King Hussein and told him he was sending over the Ramsad on a very important matter. The king agreed right away, even though he had no idea what the meeting was about. Netanyahu's aides, who were at his side at that time, maintained that he was overwhelmed with anxiety and instructed Yatom to agree to any demand of the king in exchange for the return of the agents to Israel. He also ordered Yatom to offer the antidote to the Jordanians and save Meshal from certain death. Sharon would say later, "I saw Netanyahu in the Meshal affair. He went to pieces completely and we had to assemble him again. He was under pressure and was ready to give up everything." King Hussein, distraught, listened to Yatom's report and ordered his people to find out what Mesh'al's condition was. The accurate diagnosis arrived right away. The man's condition was quickly deteriorating. The king ordered him transferred immediately to the royal hospital and accepted Yatom's offer of the antidote that could save him. In an absurd twist in this harrowing affair, the Israelis and the Jordanians engaged in a race against time to save the life of their enemy, an arch-terrorist. Mishka ben David returned to the hotel. The ampoule of the antidote was in his pocket. "I was moving around with the antidote in my possession," he said in a later interview with Ronan Bergman, "knowing that it is of no use anymore, as none of our men had been affected by the poison. Only our target was in critical condition. I decided to destroy the antidote, as I feared I might be caught with it. But then I got a call from the unit commander in Israel. He asked me if I still had the antidote, and when I said yes, he asked me to go down to the hotel lobby. A captain of the Jordanian army was waiting there for me, he said, and he had to take the antidote to the hospital right away." But at that moment, another unexpected problem arose. The doctor who was supposed to administer the antidote to the dying Mesh'al refused to do it unless the Ramsad ordered her to do so in person. Danny Yatom, who had left the royal palace and was on his way to the embassy, called her and ordered her to go with Mishka. But upon their arrival at the hospital, the Jordanians flatly refused to have an Israeli doctor inject the antidote. Perhaps they feared she would only try to finish the job. Complicating things further, the king's physician, who was charged with saving Mesh'al, refused to administer the antidote without knowing the chemical formulas of the poison and of the antidote. He did not want to assume responsibility for Mesh'al's life, lest the Israelis outsmart him and kill the man. A new crisis broke out. Both sides entrenched themselves in their positions, the Jordanians demanding the formulas and the Israelis refusing. Mesh'al's condition worsened rapidly. He stopped breathing and was connected to a respirator in the intensive care unit of the Royal Hospital. It was clear to everybody involved that if Mesh'al died, it would be disastrous for the fragile relations of the two countries. The king, who felt deeply hurt by the Israelis, even threatened to order his army to break into the embassy and arrest the four Mossad agents who had found refuge there. He also said that he would put an end to any political and military cooperation with Israel. The hours ticked by and the tension kept growing. The king announced that if Mesh'al died, he would sentence his killers, the two agents kept in custody by the Jordanian police, to death. He also placed an urgent call to U.S. President Bill Clinton. The Americans immediately started pressuring Israel to deliver the formula to the Jordanians. Netanyahu plunged into a marathon of meetings with various groups of advisors and cabinet ministers. He finally yielded and gave the formula to the Jordanians. The Jordanian doctor administered the antidote to Mesh'al. The reaction was immediate. Mesh'al opened his eyes. When the news about Mesh'al's recovery reached Israel, everybody let out a sigh of relief, as if their long-lost brother in Jordan was saved, thank God. Mishka ben David and the doctor were able to leave Jordan. Six Mossad agents remained in Amman, four at the embassy and two held by the Jordanian police. In the intensive care unit, Mesh'al's condition kept improving. Israel sent a high-level delegation to Amman, which included Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Minister of Foreign Affairs Ariel Sharon, and Minister of Defense Yitzhak Mordecai. King Hussein, however, refused to receive the delegation and sent his brother Hassan to meet them. The cabinet also summoned Ephraim Halevi, a former deputy Ramsad and King Hussein's personal friend. Halevi was now Israel's ambassador to the European Union in Brussels. He traveled to Amman immediately and offered the king a deal. In exchange for the four agents at the embassy, Israel would release from prison the charismatic founder and leader of Hamas, the Sheikh Ahmed Yassin.
The king agreed, and the four agents returned to Israel with Halevi.
The final negotiation was entrusted to Ariel Sharon, who maintained close relations with the king. Sharon demanded the release of the two Kidon agents who were still in custody. In exchange, the Jordanians demanded the release of 20 Jordanian prisoners held by Israel. Sharon agreed. But at the last moment, the Jordanians changed their mind and demanded more concessions from Israel. Sharon lost his cool in the presence of the king.
"If you continue like this," he angrily said, "our people will remain in your hands, we'll cut your water," which Israel was supplying to Jordan, "and we'll kill Mesh'al one more time."
Sharon's outburst turned out to be very effective, and the deal was closed. Two Israeli helicopters landed in Jordan. One of them took the two Kidon agents back to Israel. The other one brought over Sheikh Yassin, who had been released from prison. The Israeli and world media criticized and ridiculed the Mossad operation in Jordan. Netanyahu was also harshly attacked for his handling of the affair. He had no choice but to establish a board of inquiry to investigate the operational failure in Jordan. The board completely cleared the prime minister, but blamed the Ramsad for faults in his performance and for launching an operation that was bound to fail from the start. Yet they did not ask for Yatom's resignation. Following the fiasco in Amman, Jordan's relations with Israel reached a new low. Khalid Mesh'al, who was still a minor figure in Hamas, gained stature in the organization and became one of its major leaders. After Sheikh Yassin's death, Mesh'al rose to the overall leadership of Hamas. The prestige of the Mossad in Israel and the world, and even in the eyes of its leaders and agents, was badly scarred. Danny Yatom, who had failed all throughout the operation, was openly criticized by many of the Mossad's senior officers. Eliza Magen, Yatom's deputy, bluntly said that he was not qualified to be a Ramsad. In spite of the criticism, Yatom wouldn't resign. The only one who assumed responsibility for the mishap was the head of Caesarea, who immediately submitted his resignation. It took 5 more months, till February 1998, when a Mossad agent was arrested in Switzerland while trying to tap the phone line of a Hezbollah member, for Yatom to finally give in. "I assumed a commander's responsibility," he said in an interview with the Haaretz newspaper, "and decided to resign because of the mishaps in Jordan and Switzerland."
He was replaced by Ephraim Halevi, the former deputy Ramsad who had successfully negotiated with King Hussein the release of the four agents involved in the Mesh'al fiasco.
Chapter 18. From North Korea with Love. On a pleasant London evening in July 2007, a guest left his room in a Kensington hotel. He took the elevator to the lobby and went out to a car waiting for him by the entrance. He was a senior Syrian official who had arrived from Damascus that very afternoon. Now he was on his way to a meeting. As soon as he exited through the revolving doors, two men got up from armchairs in a far corner of the lobby. They knew exactly where to go. Reaching the Syrian's room, they gained access with a special electronic device. They were ready to search the room methodically, but this time their task was easy. A laptop computer was on the desk. The two men turned it on, and within moments, expertly installed a sophisticated version of a Trojan horse software. The program allowed them to monitor and copy from afar all the files stored in the computer's memory. The job done, the two men left the hotel undetected. Mossad analysts in Tel Aviv studied the computer files and were stunned. At an urgent meeting of department heads, they described the priceless information that had fallen into their hands. a collection of files, photographs, drawings, and documents that exposed, for the first time, Syria's top-secret nuclear program. The material was of supreme importance and included the construction plans for a nuclear reactor in a remote desert area. Correspondence between the Syrian government and high-level officials in the North Korean administration, and photographs showing the reactor encased in concrete. Another photograph showed two men. One of them turned out to be a senior official in the North Korean atomic project, and the other was Ibrahim Othman, the head of the Syrian Atomic Energy Commission. The findings confirmed several fragmentary reports that had reached the Israel intelligence community in 2006 and 2007. The reports indicated that the Syrian government was building, in utmost secrecy, a nuclear reactor at the desert site of Deir al-Zur in the far northeast of the country. The isolated site was adjacent to the Turkish border and some 100 miles from Iraqi territory. Perhaps the most surprising revelation in the reports was the fact that the Syrian facility was being planned and supervised by North Korean nuclear experts and financed by Iran. The close cooperation between Syria and North Korea had started with the 1990 visit to Damascus of North Korea's President Kim Il-sung. During that visit, at the instigation of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad, the two countries had signed an agreement on military and technological cooperation. Even though the nuclear issue was discussed in talks between the two heads of state, Assad decided to give it only secondary priority at that time and concerned himself mostly with the development of chemical and biological weapons. Moreover, he canceled plans to buy nuclear reactors from Russia. In February 1991, during Operation Desert Storm, a first shipment of Scud missiles from North Korea was unloaded in Syria. Reports on the existence of the missiles reached Moshe Arens, Israel's Minister of Defense. Several army generals recommended a military strike be initiated to destroy the Scuds before they became operational. Arens dismissed the idea, wishing to avoid another conflagration in the region. At Hafez al-Assad's funeral in June 2000, his son and successor Bashar al-Assad met with another North Korean delegation. The two parties secretly discussed the construction of a nuclear facility in Syria to be overseen by the Syrian Scientific Research Agency. In July 2002, another secret meeting was held in Damascus with the participation of senior officials from Syria, Iran, and North Korea, at which a tripartite agreement was reached. North Korea would construct a nuclear reactor in Syria to be financed by Iran. The cost of the entire project, from the drawing board to the production of weapons-grade plutonium, was estimated at $2 billion. For the next 5 years, despite small scraps of information that trickled from Damascus, neither the CIA nor the Mossad were aware of the Syrian project. Several warning lights had flashed sporadically, but had been ignored. The American intelligence services failed to grasp the meaning of the information that had accumulated, while the Mossad and Amman were misled by their own estimates that Syria had neither the capability nor the desire to obtain nuclear weapons. And no one sought to challenge that misconception, although evidence was there. In 2005, the cargo ship Andorra, a ship carrying cement from North Korea to Syria, sank close to the Israeli coastal town of Nahariya. In 2006, a second North Korean cargo vessel, sailing under a Panamanian flag, was detained in Cyprus with another cargo of cement and a portable radar station. In both cases, the cement was evidently equipment for the nuclear reactor. Finally, in late 2006, Iranian nuclear experts visited Damascus to inspect the progress of the construction of the facility. The Israeli and American intelligence services knew of this visit, but failed to realize that it was linked to the Deir al-Zur project. The Syrians took extreme precautions to protect the secrecy of the project. They imposed a total communications blackout on all the staff working at the site. Possession of cell phones and satellite devices was strictly forbidden. All communications were taken out by messengers, who carried letters and messages and delivered them by hand. The activity at the site could not be identified from space, even though American and Israeli satellites kept passing overhead. And then, suddenly, on February 7, 2007, a passenger alighted from a plane at Damascus Airport. He was Ali Reza Askari, an Iranian general and a former deputy minister of defense who had been one of the leaders of the Revolutionary Guards. See Chapter 2. He stayed at the airport until he received confirmation that his family had left Iran. He then flew on to Turkey. Soon after landing in Istanbul, he vanished. A month later, it was learned that Askari had defected to the West in an operation masterminded by the CIA and the Mossad. He was interrogated and debriefed at an American base in Germany, where he revealed the existence of the Syrian-Iranian nuclear plans and the agreement between North Korea, Iran, and Syria. He told his interlocutors that Iran was not only financing the Deir al-Zour project, but was exerting strong pressure on Syria to complete it as soon as possible. He supplied the CIA and the Mossad with a wealth of detail about the progress of the project and identified the key officials in both Syria and Iran who were involved in it. This new information shocked the Mossad into action, and it immediately switched into an operational mode. Since 2002, the Ramsad was Meir Dagan, who had replaced Ephraim Halevi. See Chapter 1. According to foreign sources, Dagan assigned units and agents to verify the Askari report. Prime Minister Ehud Olmert convened a meeting of the Army Chiefs of Staff, the Ministry of Defense, and the Intelligence Services. They unanimously agreed that an urgent operation was called for, so as to obtain solid and irrefutable information about the Deir al-Zour facility. Israel could not accept the transformation of Syria, its most implacable and aggressive foe, into a power with the potential to manufacture nuclear weapons. It was just 5 months after Askari's defection that the Mossad agents achieved their major breakthrough, the laptop of the Syrian official. The heads of the Mossad and Amman could now present Prime Minister Olmert with the definitive evidence the government needed. Soon after, Dagan allegedly pulled off another coup. In a bold and creative operation, a Mossad case officer managed to recruit one of the scientists employed at the reactor itself. He photographed the reactor extensively, both inside and out, and even made a video of the structures and equipment inside them. These were the first images the Mossad had received of the reactor, taken at ground level. They revealed a large cylindrical structure with thin but solid fortified walls. Other pictures showed an external scaffold designed to strengthen the reactor's outer walls. There were also photos of a second, smaller building equipped with oil pumps, and several trucks could be seen parked around it. A third structure was apparently a tower that supplied water for the reactor. The Mossad kept the Americans fully briefed at every step and furnished them with copies of all reports and photos, including satellite pictures and transcripts of phone calls between Syria and North Korea. Under relentless pressure from Israel, the United States put its own satellites on the case. Both the satellite pictures and electronic tracking of the exchange of phone calls indicated that the Syrians were constructing at breakneck speed. In June 2007, Prime Minister Olmert flew to Washington with all the material Israel had collected. He met with President Bush and told him Israel had decided that the Syrian reactor had to be destroyed. Olmert suggested that the United States carry out an airstrike against the reactor, but the American president refused. According to American sources, the White House responded that the U.S. chooses not to attack the reactor. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates tried to persuade Israel to confront the Syrians but not attack. Bush and National Security Advisor Steve Hadley expressed their support for military action in principle, but asked that any operation be delayed until more clearly threatening intelligence could be obtained. In July 2007, Israel carried out high-altitude air sorties and programmed its OFEC-7 spy satellite to take detailed photographs of the reactor. These photos, when analyzed by American and Israeli experts, established clearly that Syria was building a reactor identical to North Korea's nuclear facility at Yongbyon. A video that Israel shared with the United States showed that the cores of both reactors were identical, including the way in which the uranium rods were placed inside the structure. Other videos even showed the faces of North Korean engineers working inside the reactor. Additionally, the Amman Intercept Department, Unit 8200, produced full transcripts of hectic exchanges between Damascus and Pyongyang. All this evidence was relayed to Washington, but the United States still demanded irrefutable proof that the facility was indeed a nuclear reactor and that radioactive materials were actually in place. Israel felt it had no choice but to obtain this information as well. In August 2007, Israel came up with the ultimate proof that the facility at Deir al-Zour was a nuclear reactor. It was obtained by an elite commando unit, Sayeret Matkal, in an operation that risked the lives of scores of Israeli soldiers. Sayeret Matkal commandos flew to Syria by night in two helicopters. They were wearing Syrian army uniforms. Bypassing populated areas, military bases, and radar stations, they landed undetected close to Deir al-Zour, then approached the reactor site and collected soil samples from the earth surrounding the reactor. Upon analysis back in Israel, these samples were found to be highly radioactive, proving irrefutably that radioactive substances were indeed on site. This new evidence was presented to Steve Hadley. Once his experts had checked the soil samples, he realized that the matter was deadly serious. He summoned his closest aides, and their conclusions were brought before President Bush at Hadley's daily briefing at the Oval Office. Hadley then held talks with Dagan and concluded that the reactor indeed posed a clear and present danger. The United States now accepted that the Syrian reactor had to be eliminated and codenamed the Deir al-Zour operation the Orchard. In his memoirs, George W. Bush wrote that he considered for a while attacking the reactor, but after discussing the options with his national security team, he finally decided against it. He felt that bombing a sovereign country with no warning or announced justification would create severe blowback. He also ruled out a covert raid by U.S. soldiers. Nevertheless, Olmert phoned President Bush and asked him to destroy the reactor. During the phone conversation, Bush was in the Oval Office, surrounded by his closest aides, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Vice President Dick Cheney, Steve Hadley, and his deputy Elliot Abrams, and others. In the preliminary consultations, Rice had convinced them to reject Israel's demand. "George, I'm asking you to bomb the compound," Olmert said. "I cannot justify an attack on a sovereign nation," Bush replied, "unless my intelligence agencies stand up and say it's a weapons program." Bush recommended using diplomacy. "Your strategy is very disturbing to me," Olmert bluntly said. "I'll do what I believe necessary to protect Israel." "This guy has balls," Bush later said. "That's why I like him." According to London's Sunday Times, Prime Minister Olmert met with Minister of Defense Ehud Barak and Minister of Foreign Affairs Tzipi Livni. The three of them, together with the heads of the defense and intelligence communities, discussed the new evidence, as well as the possible repercussions of a military strike. Finally, the die was cast. The Syrian reactor would be eliminated. The Prime Minister briefed opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu and received his wholehearted support. The date for the attack was set for the night of September 5, 2007. The previous day, according to a later report in the Sunday Times, another elite commando unit, Shaldag, Kingfisher, had reached the Deir al-Zour area. The men spent almost a day in hiding close to the reactor. Their mission was to illuminate the reactor with laser beams the following night so the Air Force jets could home in directly on the target. At 11 p.m. on September 5th, 10 F-15 aircraft took off from Ramat David Air Force Base and headed west over the Mediterranean. 30 minutes later, three of the planes were ordered to return to base. The other seven were instructed to head for the Turkish-Syrian border and turn south toward Deir al-Zour. On the way, they bombed a radar station, crippling the Syrian air defense's ability to identify the approach of foreign aircraft. Minutes later, they reached Deir al-Zour, and from a carefully calculated distance, they launched Maverick air-to-surface missiles and half-ton bombs, hitting their target with precision. The Syrian reactor, intended to build atomic bombs for Israel's destruction, was obliterated in seconds. Prime Minister Olmert, anxious to avoid a Syrian military reaction, established urgent contact with the Prime Minister of Turkey, Tayyip Erdogan, and asked him to convey a message to President Assad. Israel had no intention of going to war with Syria, Olmert emphasized, but could not accept a nuclear Syria on its doorstep. But Olmert's reassurance proved unnecessary. On the morning after the bombing, the reaction from Damascus was total silence. Not a word was uttered by government spokesmen. Only at 3 o'clock that afternoon was an official statement issued by the Syrian news agency. It stated that Israeli aircraft had penetrated Syrian airspace at 1 a.m. Our Air Force forced them to retreat after they had dropped ammunition over a deserted area. There was no damage to people or equipment. The world media was desperate to learn how the Mossad had managed to obtain photos and even videos from the interior of the Syrian reactor. ABC television reported that Israel either had planted an agent inside the Syrian reactor, or the Mossad had recruited one of the engineers who had supplied it with the pictures of the facility. In April 2008, some 7 months after the destruction of the reactor, the American administration finally announced that the Syrian facility had been a nuclear reactor built with North Korean support and that it was not designed for peaceful uses. George W. Bush thought Olmert's execution of the strike against the Syrian reactor had restored the confidence he had lost in the Israelis during their 2006 war against Lebanon, which Bush felt was bungled. Officials in the U.S. intelligence community showed amazed congressmen and senators slides that made clear the similarity between the Syrian reactor and the North Korean Yongbyon reactor, a slideshow with the satellite photos, drawings, and plans, as well as the videos, established the provenance of these materials. Israel succeeded in keeping the secret for just 2 weeks, during which it denied it had attacked the reactor. But then opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu, interviewed on a live newscast, declared, "When the cabinet takes action for Israel's security, I give it my full backing. And here, too, I was a partner in this affair from the first moment, and I gave it my full support." A final episode in the Syrian nuclear project took place 11 months later, on August 2, 2008. That evening, a convivial dinner party was taking place on the spacious veranda of a beach house at Rimal el-Zahabiya, north of the Syrian port of Tartus. The house, close to the water, had a spectacular view of the Mediterranean. The veranda, facing the dark waves, was a welcome refuge from the humidity of the Syrian coast. A soft sea breeze cooled the stifling midsummer heat. The guests, seated at an oblong table, were close friends of the villa's owner, General Muhammad Suleiman, who had invited them for a relaxing weekend. Suleiman was President Assad's closest advisor on military and defense matters. He had supervised the building of the reactor and managed its security. In the highest circles of power in Syria, he was regarded as Assad's shadow. His office was in the palace, adjacent to that of the president, yet he was known only to a select few, both inside and outside the country. His name was never mentioned in the Syrian media, but the Mossad knew of him and had followed his activities closely. The 47-year-old Suleiman had studied engineering at Damascus University, where he had met and befriended another student, Basil al-Assad, the favorite son and heir apparent of President Hafez al-Assad. When Basil was killed in a road accident in 1994, Assad introduced Suleiman to his younger son, Bashar. Assad died of cancer in 2000, and Bashar replaced him as president, and then appointed Suleiman his confidant and trusted aide. Suleiman soon became one of the most powerful men in Syria. President Assad charged him with supervision of all sensitive military matters. He became the senior liaison between the president and the Iranian intelligence services, especially on matters concerning their secret cooperation with terrorist organizations in the Middle East. He was also the primary Syrian contact with Hezbollah and maintained a close relationship with that organization's military chief, Imad Mughniyeh. After Israel had withdrawn from the security zone in South Lebanon in May 2000, Suleiman took charge of the transfer of weapons from Iran and Syria to Hezbollah, especially the delivery of long-range rockets. During the Second Lebanon War in 2006, one such rocket scored a direct hit on the Israeli railway workshops in Haifa, killing 8 workers. Later on, Suleiman supplied Hezbollah with Syrian-manufactured surface-to-air missiles, thus jeopardizing Israel's air activities in Lebanon. And Suleiman held another unique and top-secret position. He was a senior member of the Syrian Research Committee that dealt with the development of long-range rockets, chemical and biological weapons, and nuclear research. He had overseen the liaison with North Korea, coordinated the shipment of reactor parts to Syria, and directed the security measures isolating the North Korean technicians and engineers working on the construction of the reactor. Israel's destruction of the reactor was a heavy blow for Suleiman. After recovering from the initial shock, he started planning another reactor, the location of which was yet to be decided. But Suleiman's life had become more difficult. He knew now that he was wanted by both the American and Israeli secret services. So, before embarking on plans for his next stage, he took a few days' leave at his home in Ramal el-Zahabiya. A quiet weekend with good friends and excellent food seemed the best way to alleviate his stress. From the center of his large table, Suleiman watched the waves rolling toward the beach, but he failed to notice 2 motionless figures crouching in the water some 150 yards away. They had swum in from the sea, where a boat had dropped them off about a mile from Suleiman's home. Israeli naval commandos and expert sharpshooters, they carried scuba equipment and had made their way underwater to the beach opposite the house. As their feet touched bottom, they stood and picked out Suleiman's home. They studied the house and the veranda, looked at all the people seated at the table, and focused on their target, the general sitting between his guests. At 9 p.m., the sharpshooters calibrated their sights and adjusted the range. The veranda was crowded, and the 2 uninvited guests in their black diving suits wanted to make sure they could fire at the general without harming anybody else. They emerged from the water and took a few steps, then aimed their weapons equipped with silencers at Suleiman's head. An electronic signal beeped in their earphones, and they fired simultaneously. The shots were fatal. Suleiman's head flew back, and he collapsed forward onto the food-laden table. The guests at first did not grasp what had happened. Only when they noticed the blood oozing from Suleiman's head did they understand he had been shot. All hell broke loose on the veranda, some trying to come to their host's aid, others crouching in fear or aimlessly running around, shouting and yelling. In the uproar, the two sharpshooters disappeared. The Sunday Times published a slightly different version of the event. It said that the sharpshooters were members of the Israeli Naval Commando, Flotilla 13, who had arrived on the Syrian coast aboard a yacht belonging to an Israeli businessman and had sailed back immediately after fulfilling their mission. When the news reached Damascus, it caused a tremendous shock, but the government kept silent and did not respond to the media coverage. The military and security establishments were confused. How did the hit team reach Tartus, which was 140 miles away from Damascus? How did they escape? Was there no place in Syria where its leaders were safe? Only after a few days, a laconic communique was issued, announcing that Syria is undertaking an investigation to find the perpetrators of this crime. But the press in other Arab countries had not waited for this official reaction. From the outset, it had published extensive coverage, with detailed reports and speculation about the identity of the assassins. The Arab media focused on who had an interest in eliminating this general and pointed an accusing finger at Israel, claiming that Israel had carried out the assassination because of Suleiman's role in the Deir al-Zour reactor. The reaction of the Western secret services was different. None shed a tear over Suleiman's death. In June 2010, Flotilla 13 was decorated by the Commander-in-Chief of the Israel Defense Forces for several feats of arms, the nature of which was not revealed. One may wonder if the honors bestowed on the Naval Commando Unit are not, at least in part, in recognition of the Suleiman operation. Chapter 19. Love and Death in the Afternoon. On February 12, 2008, several men surreptitiously fanned out around an apartment building in an exclusive Damascus neighborhood. In the late afternoon, they saw a silver Mitsubishi Pajero SUV parked by the building. A man in a black suit, with a smartly trimmed beard, got out of the vehicle and entered the house. He was not accompanied by bodyguards. The agents posted on the street whispered in their miniature transmitters that the man had arrived in Damascus and he was on his way to the apartment. They knew that the man in black was about to meet his secret lover, Nihad Haidar, a Syrian woman, who was waiting for him in the apartment. The man was carrying a present for gorgeous Nihad, who celebrated her 30th birthday that week. The lovers spent a few hours in the luxurious apartment that was left at their disposal by Rami Makhlouf, a successful businessman and the cousin of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Shortly before 10 p.m., the man in black left the building and got into the silver Pajero. He was on his way to a meeting in a discreet safe house in the Kafr Susa neighborhood, where he met with Iranian, Syrian, and Palestinian envoys. According to the London Sunday Express, the agents following him checked an updated photo of the man on the screens of their mobile phones to make sure there would be no identification mistake. They kept open lines of transmission and reported every move of the mark to the Mossad command post. When he left the building, where he had spent a few hours with Nihad, the agents had a good opportunity to check his face against the photos on their screens. They confirmed the identification to their colleagues in Damascus and to headquarters in Tel Aviv. An overwhelming tension swept the Mossad. the department heads gathered in Meir Dagan's office, where all the necessary equipment was set up for monitoring the operation in real time.
The man started the silver Pajero.
"He's on his way," whispered one of the agents into his miniature mic.
The man in the silver Pajero was Imad Mughniya, who had left a bloody trail, years long, behind him.
November 15, 2001. Following the attack on the Twin Towers, the FBI publishes a large poster containing the list of the most wanted terrorists in the world. The poster is stamped with the logos of the FBI, the State Department, and the Department of Justice. The list shows 22 names and 22 pictures. The first name is the most dangerous of them all. The award for his capture is $5 million. Until the attack on the Twin Towers, he had been considered as responsible for the deaths of more Americans than any other living terrorist. Imad Mughniya. April 18, 1983. Bombing of the American Embassy in Beirut, Lebanon. 63 dead. October 23, 1983. Bombing of the U.S. Marines headquarters in Beirut. 241 dead. October 23, 1983, same day, bombing of the French paratrooper headquarters in Beirut, 58 dead. And the abduction and murder of CIA official William Buckley, several attacks on the American embassy in Kuwait, hijacking of a TWA airliner and two planes of the Kuwait airline, the murder of Colonel W.R. Higgins of the UN Observer Force in South Lebanon, massacre of 20 American soldiers in Saudi Arabia. When the above list is sent to Israel, the Mossad adds its own data. November 4, 1983, bombing of the IDF headquarters in Tyre, Lebanon, 60 dead. March 10, 1985, attack on an IDF convoy by Metullah on the Israeli-Lebanese border, 8 dead. March 17, 1992, bombing of the Israeli embassy in Argentina, 29 dead. July 18, 1994, bombing of the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, 86 dead. And the abduction and murder of three Israeli soldiers at the Har Dov border sector, the abduction of Israeli businessman Elhanan Tannenbaum, a bombing near Kibbutz Matsuba, and the most destructive of them all, the abduction and murder of the soldiers Regev and Goldwasser on the Israeli-Lebanese border, which triggered the Second Lebanon War. Imad Mughniya, the arch-terrorist behind all those crimes, was a ghost who moved constantly between the Middle East capitals. He evaded photographers and refused to be interviewed. The Western Secret Services knew a lot about his activities, but almost nothing about his outward appearance, his habits, and his hideouts. They knew he was born in 1962 in a South Lebanon village. According to the fragmentary reports, his parents were devoted Shiites. While in his teens, he had moved to Beirut and grown up in a poor neighborhood mostly populated by Palestinians, supporters of the PLO. He had dropped out of high school and joined the Fatah, the terrorist branch of the PLO. Later, he had become the bodyguard of Abu Ayyad, Arafat's deputy, and became a member of Force 17, the special security unit of the Fatah organization that was formed in the mid-70s and commanded by Ali Hassan Salameh, the Red Prince. See Chapter 12. But in 1982, Israel launched the Lebanon War, called Operation Peace for Galilee, invaded Lebanon, and crushed the PLO. Its surviving members, headed by Yasser Arafat, were exiled to Tunisia. Mughniya, though, decided to stay behind and joined the first group of Hezbollah founders. The Hezbollah, literally the Party of God, was a Shiite terrorist organization created in 1982 in response to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Inspired by the Ayatollah Khomeini, trained and supplied by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, the Hezbollah became Israel's vile enemy, defining its main goal as Israel's final departure from Lebanon as a prelude to its final obliteration. From the first day of its existence, Hezbollah engaged in violent acts of terrorism against Israel, and Mugnia was an ideal recruit for the nascent group. As a real man of shadows, he chose to operate in secret and refrained from appearing in public. The reports about him became fragmentary and often contradictory. One source described him as the bodyguard of Sheikh Fadlallah, the Hezbollah spiritual leader, while another claimed he had become the operations chief of the organization, the brain behind Hezbollah's most risky actions, which ended in bloodbaths. Unlike the present Hezbollah leader, the Sheikh Nasrallah, Mugnia never appeared on television and never made hateful speeches, but in reality, he was far more dangerous than the loquacious Sheikh. He soon rose to the position of the most efficient and most elusive terrorist in the world, like Carlos in his time and like his colleague and great admirer, Osama bin Laden. Mugnia was a cruel and creative terrorist. He emerged suddenly when he planned and commanded several mass massacres in Lebanon at the end of Operation Peace for Galilee. He was only 21 years old on this day in October 1983 when he sent explosive-laden trucks, driven by suicide bombers, to the compounds of the American Marines and the French paratroopers in Beirut. A few days later, he repeated the same scenario against the IDF headquarters in Tyre. At 22, he led a group of terrorists on an attack against the fortified American embassy in Kuwait and afterward hijacked his first plane there. After each of his operations, he vanished into thin air. At 23, Mugnia hijacked a TWA plane on its way from Athens to Rome and forced its pilot to land in Beirut Airport. During the hijacking, he murdered Navy diver Robert Dean Stethem and threw his body out the cockpit door. Mugnia escaped after the hijacking operation that lasted 17 days, but this time he left behind a memento, his fingerprint in the aircraft restroom. Almost nothing was known about his private life, except for his marriage to his cousin, who gave him a son and a daughter. At a very early age, he knew he was in the crosshairs of several Western secret services and tried to conceal his identity. He went through a rudimentary plastic surgery in Libya, grew a beard, and stayed out of the limelight. Only a single confirmed photo of Mugnia, fat, bearded, wearing glasses and a visor cap, made its way to the Western services. His description was flawed as well. The FBI portrayed him as born in Lebanon, speaking Arabic, brown hair and beard, height 5 feet 8 inches, 170 centimeters, weight 120 pounds, about 60 kilograms. It is hard to imagine how Mugnia's generous dimensions managed to shrink into a 120 pound model body, but the description only reconfirmed that Mugnia protected himself well and succeeded in misleading all his enemies. After all the attacks, bombings, and hijackings he carried out, he became an admired hero of the Hezbollah. He was lauded for his sophistication, his bravery, and his operational talents that made the Hezbollah's military arm feared by the world's intelligence services. As his power increased, he became a major target for assassination by Israel and the West. Mugnia realized this and became a paranoid who lived a life of eternal flight, suspected everybody, including his closest confidants, changed his bodyguards very often, and slept every night in another place. His trips between Beirut, Damascus, and Tehran took place under a thick veil of secrecy. According to the profile prepared by Israel and other secret services, Mugnia was a loner, very charismatic, very impulsive, and very knowledgeable about the newest electronic instruments and gadgets. He had an uncanny capacity for changing identities and appearances, which enabled him to fool his enemies. Israeli secret agents used to call him the terrorist with 9 lives. Amman officer David Barkai, a former major in the secret intelligence unit 504 that assembled the profile file on Mugnia, said in an interview to the British Sunday Times, "We tried to knock him down several times in the late 1980s. We accumulated intelligence on him, but the closer we got, the less information we gleaned. No weak points, no women, money, drugs, nothing." The hunt for Mugnia lasted for many years. In 1988, he was almost captured by the French authorities when his plane made a stopover in Paris. The CIA had supplied the French with information about Mugnia, including his photograph and some details about the false passport he was using. But the French feared that his arrest might cause the murder of the French hostages that were held in Lebanon at that time, so they chose to ignore his presence and let him go away. The American services tried to capture him in Europe in 1986 and in Saudi Arabia in 1995, but he disappeared, as always. In those years, Mugnia was deeply involved in planning and executing attacks on Israelis and Jews in Argentina. In 1992, he organized the bombing of the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires by a truck stuffed with explosives, driven by a suicide bomber. 29 people were killed. Some of the heads of the Mossad saw in the operation an act of revenge for the killing of Hezbollah's leader Sheikh Abbas al-Musawi in a helicopter attack in South Lebanon. 2 years later, another bombing shook Buenos Aires, this time at the Jewish Community Center, leaving 86 dead. Once again, some experts thought Hezbollah was avenging the abduction by Israel of one of its leaders, Mustafa Dirani, in Lebanon. Intelligence crews from the United States and Israel, who flew to Buenos Aires to investigate the two bombings, concluded that they were connected. The modus operandi was identical: loading a truck with explosives and sending it to its target with a suicide bomber behind the wheel. Mugnia had used exactly the same method in Beirut and in Tyre at the outset of his career. The investigators established that the Iranian secret services and their local collaborators were involved in the bombings as well. At least one of the trucks, the one that had served for the embassy bombing, had been sold to the terrorists by a Buenos Aires Shiite car dealer, Carlos Alberto Taladin. The trail clearly led to Imad Mugnia. In those years, Mugnia spent long stretches of time in Iran. After the assassination of Sheikh al-Musawi, he feared that Israel would try to kill him too. In Tehran, he created an operational team composed of Hezbollah fighters and Iranian intelligence officers. His partners in setting up that unit were the commander-in-chief of the Revolutionary Guards, Mohsen Rezaei, and the Minister of Intelligence, Ali Falahian. Apparently, that unit carried out the 2 deadly attacks in Buenos Aires. These attacks had one result: Mugnia became Israel's most wanted man. By his acts, he sentenced himself to death. But long years would pass by before his death sentence would be carried out. In December 1994, Mugnia was seen in Beirut. Shortly after, he escaped an assassination attempt by a booby-trapped car in a southern neighborhood. The Lebanese police quickly published its findings. An explosive charge had been placed underneath a car parked near the mosque where Sheikh Fadlallah read his sermon. The explosion destroyed the store of Fuad Mugnia, Imad's brother, and his body was found in the rubble. But Imad, who was supposed to be there, changed his mind at the last moment, decided not to come, and survived. His 9 lives saved him again. A few weeks after the bombing, the security services, acting jointly with the Hezbollah, arrested several civilians suspected of being involved in the attack as Mossad collaborators. The main suspect was a man named Ahmed Halek. According to the official police statement, Halek and his wife had parked their car close to Fuad Mugnia's store. Halek entered the store to make sure that Fuad was there, shook his hand, returned to the car, and activated the bomb. The Lebanese newspaper As-Safir, quoting reliable sources, said that Halek had participated in a meeting with a senior Mossad official in Cyprus. The Mossad officer had instructed him how to use the bomb and paid him about $100,000. Halek was subsequently executed. This time, Mugnia escaped, but the Mossad agents did not give up. They painstakingly collected every small detail they could find, compiled reports from foreign intelligence services, and studied Mugnia's personal methods. In 2002, the Mossad received another report about Mugnia, linking him to the shipping of 50 tons of weapons to Palestinian terrorists. But then he vanished again, although rumors had it that he had become the commander-in-chief of the Hezbollah and the likely successor of Sheikh Nasrallah. His main connection was with Iranian intelligence, and he was said to act jointly with the Al-Quds, the Arab name of Jerusalem, brigades, charged with the cooperation with Shiite communities throughout the world and with Iranian-controlled terrorist organizations.